While everybody is getting coffee, settling down, wanted to get started, let me introduce our first panel. The panel will be speaking on enforcing foreign judgments. We won the battle, now what? The panel consists of Chad Alvaro, Caroline Berube, Bob Gegios, Lipu Lee, and Betty Sousa.
Good afternoon. That was a hard act to follow, but we'll try to keep you entertained as much as we can with respect to talking about foreign judgments. Early in the discussion about this program, we realized that a foreign judgment, if you are in the U.S., means a judgment that was obtained elsewhere that you're trying to bring to the United States. On the other hand, a foreign judgment, if you were in China, like Caroline, or Taiwan, like Lipu, would mean a judgment that came from someplace other than their home country and was trying to be enforced there. So we decided that we wanted to incorporate a little bit of both with respect to what this program is today. And then we also discussed the fact that you've got to kind of go back and talk about how did you get to the point that you have a foreign judgment. And it's important in that discussion to include the topics such as where would you have gotten the judgment? Would it be an award in an arbitration, or would it be in a particular court? What court would you be using in order to get the judgment if you had control over these things? Here in our country, or where the other party to the transaction is? And then sort of thinking about the old subject matter, personal jurisdiction ideas that we would have learned the first year in law school, just sort of refreshing our recollection about it. Remember, subject matter jurisdiction is whether the court has the authority to rule on that particular controversy. And then personal jurisdiction, of course, is whether the court has the ability to impose a judgment or enter a ruling with respect to that party. And so that can occur, remember, in sort of the due process, big picture way, if a party has minimum contacts with the forum, or if there's been consent. And most of the transactions that probably are involved today are arising from some form of written documents, be they lease agreements, contracts for sale, whatever type of transaction it might be. There's probably a consent to jurisdiction, a consent to the forum, and a consent to the choice of law. And so that is something that you have to keep in mind if you are at the beginning of this process deciding where you're going to sue and what court or arbitration. And then, of course, you can gain jurisdiction by way of service. Something that you can't deal with this issue without thinking about are the assets of the party that you are seeking to recover if you're trying to get a money judgment or you're trying to impose some form of specific performance related to those assets. So that's always got to be at the forefront, thinking about where are the assets? Where are the assets, and do I have any potential right to get to assets through some form of pre-judgment remedy, claim and delivery, replevin, some states call it, attachment. Is there some way to freeze and hold those assets? Preliminary injunction, something that would keep the damage, stop the bleeding, if you will, during the pendency of the lawsuit. Those are all sort of preliminary ideas that are being discussed or should be discussed. And let's see. Now that's taking me back. Should go to the next one. And then, so, wrong. It seems to be going the wrong direction. Sorry. You know what? I'm going to go ahead and start talking, and I'll get the slides to catch up with me. Chad, give us a little bit of history. I mean, we had the U.S. formed American Revolution. It wasn't like an American networking event with Europe. I mean, how did we come to be where we are with respect to accepting foreign judgments?
Well, I think the history, while a little dry, goes back. I'm going to talk first about the uniform acts that apply, kind of the historical genesis of those uniform acts that might apply, as well as a case that kind of illustrates some of the issues we run into in the application of those acts. Now, all in about 10 to 15 minutes, so wish me luck. And I also don't want to bore you to tears. But in any event, amongst corporate counsel, how many folks have taken a judgment in the U.S. and sought to enforce it abroad? Anyone? And how about vice versa? Has anyone obtained a judgment abroad and sought to enforce it here? Same folks, pretty much. Well, if you've sought recognition in the states of a foreign judgment, that is, a judgment rendered abroad, you're probably familiar with the Uniform Acts promulgated by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform Laws. And there's two of them. And the first one was enacted in 1962, and it was a significant event. It was significant because not much had happened since the Supreme Court's first pronouncement on the issues back in the case of Hilton versus Guillot. And Carolyn can correct my French if I'm saying it wrong, but I think it's Guillot. In any event, in that case, French nationals sought to enforce judgments obtained in France in New York. The case went up to the Supreme Court and ultimately held that French judgments are not necessarily conclusive. Foreign judgments are not necessarily conclusive between the parties, and that a court sitting in the United States can review those judgments. So it introduced two important concepts to the history, that of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, not comedy, because there's nothing funny about it, unfortunately, for me, and reciprocity. Comity, explained by the court, is something that sovereign nations give to one another out of respect, goodwill, and, quote, grace amongst sovereign nations. It's not something that's an obligation. It's not something that necessarily must occur as between sovereign nations. And reciprocity grew out of that. The court basically said, if we don't have to recognize your foreign judgments, but we might do it as long as you recognize ours. So that was kind of the genesis of reciprocity in the law, and that was how the case law shook out over the 70 or so years before the enactment of the 62 Uniform Act. So the 62 Uniform Act kind of resolved some of the uncertainty that had arisen as a result of Guillot, and it was adopted in the majority of states, not all of them. And it's not in Wisconsin, I don't believe. Maybe Bob can speak to that at some point. But the important aspects of the Act is that it applies unless there are grounds for non-recognition, the judgment is conclusive as between the parties. So the first question that we approach is, does the Act apply? Do either of the Acts apply? Well, the Act to apply must be for a judgment that is final, not on appeal, and for money. You can't necessarily have the enforcement of a specific performance judgment rendered abroad in the United States. There has to be a component, at least, of money damages. Assuming the Act applies, the Act then, the 62 Act, sets forth the grounds for non-recognition. And the grounds for non-recognition, we can't really go through them all sitting here today, but the important ones are the mandatory non-recognition grounds. That is, there are circumstances where if a judgment was rendered under those circumstances, an American court cannot recognize it. And the important one is that the final judgment from outside the U.S. cannot be enforced in the U.S. if the court entering the judgment didn't have jurisdiction over the parties. That's the first very important one, and it sounds in both subject matter jurisdiction as well as in personal jurisdiction. The other important one is that if the judgment was rendered under a system that's incompatible with due process, it can't be enforced in the U.S. So practically speaking, if you're pursuing litigation abroad, anticipate whether or not it's going to be subject to enforcement in the United States or recognition in the United States. And personal jurisdiction, have your file on personal jurisdiction set up in advance. If there are holes in service of process, make sure that those are fixed. If service was somehow defective, do it again. But anticipate that personal jurisdiction is the single issue that can be the most troubling in seeking to recognize the judgment later on. But the 62 Act left a lot of holes, and those holes were hotly litigated, and among them were the issues of burdens of proof. A number of cases came out and said that where the Act applies, the person seeking to enforce or recognize that judgment has to basically disprove the grounds for recognition, which is a real tough burden for someone seeking to establish recognition of the judgment in the states. So the 2005 Act kind of filled all those holes, and the primary one being the burdens of proof. Under the 2005 Act, which has now been adopted in a minority of states, the burden of proof is initially on the person seeking to enforce the judgment, seeking to recognize the judgment to show this act applies. That is three things. The judgment's conclusive, it's final, not subject to appeal, and it's for a money judgment. Once that happens, the burden then switches to the defendant, the party seeking to avoid recognition, and that defendant has to carry the burden of showing some grounds for non-recognition. So under the Act, the non-recognition bases are treated as affirmative defenses. The 2005 Act was significant in the sense that it changes the way that we litigate these cases. Having talked about kind of the general grounds for non-recognition, a case out of the Southern District of Florida where I practice is illustrative of some of the issues, and it's kind of shocking when you think about it. In the Osorio versus Dole case out of the Southern District of Florida, a group of farm workers in Nicaragua filed suit against Dole Fruit and Dow Chemical, essentially seeking to recover for sterility allegedly caused from the application of pesticides in Nicaragua back in the 70s.
We're talking about the pineapple, Dole pineapple.
Dole pineapple, right. And Dow Chemical probably more. won't talk about that. But the special law in place, in Nicaragua under which these plaintiffs sued tilted the balance so far in favor of the plaintiffs that it seems shocking to us just reading the opinion. And I do recommend you read it. It's 50 pages. It's kind of compelling. I guess nerds like myself. But in any event, the law under which those plaintiffs sued basically provided an irrefutable presumption of causation as between the sterility that these plaintiffs supposedly contracted or experienced and the application of the pesticides. So by law, it said, if these events are proven, you can't refute causation. It also required, again shockingly, the defendants to post about $1 million deposit at the very outset of the case to cover the plaintiff's damages. So you kind of get the idea that the courts, the legislature, by enacting that law, is assuming these plaintiffs are going to recover. And finally, it provided that these cases, claims under this law, are litigated in a 383 summary proceeding. What's a 383 summary proceeding? Discovery is done in 3 days, trial is done in 8 days. Trial judge makes a determination in another 3 days. So a complex pesticide case resolved in 14 days. So not surprisingly, under those circumstances, the plaintiffs got a $97 million judgment and brought it over to the United States to try and enforce it against Dole and Dow. So the district court confronted the situation and held that judgment could not be enforced on a number of grounds. It found that the law that gave rise to the plaintiff's causes of action is not compatible with due process. It found the court didn't have personal jurisdiction, and it found that the judgment offended Florida's public policy against irrefutable legislative presumptions. So significantly, and I think the court was a little bit uncomfortable in looking at the law of a different jurisdiction, but the court determined that Nicaragua at that time did not provide an impartial tribunal that could grant these defendants a fair trial. In fact, it said the judicial system there has all the trappings of an independent judiciary, but in the practical sense is not independent and is rife with political influence. So the court held that the judgment was unenforceable, a $97 million judgment held unenforceable. And I think, what do we learn from that? Well, we learn that you need to consider whether or not the judgment or the claims that you're suing on are going to be enforceable if a judgment's entered on them in the U.S. For instance, I know there are some causes of action abroad for damaging speech, for instance, that would be protected by the First Amendment. So ordinarily, those sorts of claims aren't going to be enforceable in the United States. So some foresight is required to kind of figure out what we're going to be encountering down the line when we seek to enforce the judgment. Now, in this Osorio case on appeal to the 11th Circuit here in Atlanta, the court affirmed on all counts except was not willing to go as far as to say Nicaragua does not offer an impartial tribunal. Specifically, I think in an act of kind of judicial diplomacy, declined to find that Nicaragua was not a good forum. So that case teaches us a lot, and it requires us to look at forum, because forum is inextricably intertwined with the idea that you'll be enforcing that judgment later.
That's great. Now, first I want to show the slides real quick. This is the older act, and the darker states are the ones that enacted it. Keep in mind, a uniform act just means that if a state chooses to enact it, they will enact, hopefully, the same version that every other state that enacts it. And then this is the revised act. As you can see, even fewer states have enacted the revised act, which is 2005, isn't that right?
2005, Dad?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Bob, let's talk about arbitration. Help us understand. We hear so much about arbitration perhaps being a preferred forum for disputes involving companies in different countries.
Okay. Well, firstly, we have some differences when we're in the arbitration world. And I'm going to try to keep my comments very practical. I don't want to get into all the differences. But there are some treaties. There's a New York Convention. There's a Panama Convention. And there is an ability to get to an area that the states don't have for purposes of a good old court decision. But we do have a couple benefits here with regard to the arbitration setting, because the parties have agreed to something. They've actually said they'd like a matter handled a certain way, which isn't the case when you're dealing with an involuntary setting. Someone sued you, your company. But I'm going to suggest, and I think these suggestions play right into the court type of proceedings and trying to effectuate judgments there, that based on experience, it's not going to make much difference, because what you're really dealing with here are exceptions, whether they're the strict letter of the law, as you just heard Chad explain to you, or not. There are places to drive holes through. For example, a due process exception, a public policy exception. There really aren't much in the way of limitations placed on that, and that's going to allow a court to look at issues quite differently than if it was required somehow. There's no full faith and credit kind of provision here in any of these acts or treaties. So what you're dealing with here, and I'm going to harken back to something I said at this forum a couple years ago when we were talking about cross-cultural differences and the arbitration setting, international arbitrations. You're dealing with cross-cultural issues and problems, and they're arising because there's a perception that has been driven by people's own perceptions through their particular cultures, that differences are not good, and they'll be worked out in a way that will favor the person making the decision, whatever culture that's coming from. So, for example, you're dealing with a matter as simple as corruption. It's a very practical, real concern. It's left under the table in discussions, but it's there in all these. Are you dealing with a jurisdiction where some of these officials may be corrupt? It's going to raise a red flag, and it's going to put a burden. It's not a written down burden. It's a burden from someone who's coming from a jurisdiction with a judgment, and there is some concern about that, a bias, something of that nature. And a very simple one is civil versus common law. Let's say you're in a jurisdiction, pick France, for example, and you've got a Napoleonic code, and it's talking about something, some fairness, and someone's been sued over in France and doesn't understand this. It may not be a First Amendment issue. It could be a right of privacy issue, all these things. All of a sudden, there is a judgment coming down from a French court, and to emphasize the point here, that's something that is so untoward for common law thinkers, as in this country. If someone's coming from overseas to enforce it, you're going to have some difficulties. You're going to have to do some explanations. So you can expect practically that you're going to litigate some issues. Whoever's got the technical burden of proof, you're going to have to get into some issues. Now, if you're the proponent of of this challenge, if you're coming in to say this shouldn't be enforced, what are you going to look at? What kinds of things? Well, there's very broad discretion, whether you're in a court setting with a treaty that's applying or just straight on trying to domesticate a judgment, the other side is, you're going to try to show what is lacking and what is going to resonate with a particular judge. You're going to do that same thing if you're going overseas. What is lacking? It could be a matter of jurisdiction. It can be a matter of service of process, a claim that sounds, as I just mentioned, sort of strange. You're not going to be able to deal with a default judgment because there's been no hearing. You may have an issue over how long it took a decision to come down, although I would say going the other direction, I've been in enough rocket dockets in the United States to know that I don't know that I feel I've gotten a fair trial, even if I've won in a rocket docket here when decisions come down. The amount of the judgment is going to be an issue, too. Does it strike somebody as not conscionable, just not reasonable in terms of this? And it's very hard to pick somebody, let's say, in North Dakota, a judge there, to enforce something when the person has no idea, the poor judge, exactly what this claim is all about. Does it have something that is close enough to a common law feeling that the judge can get some sense over it? So you've got lots of opportunity to do that. And you have to know if you're coming in, you're representing a foreign company, that you have to think about what's happening here. It happens going from Illinois to Wisconsin, but nothing like when you're dealing in an international setting. You've got a situation where you're asking a court to domesticate a judgment. That's really what's happening. So it's a judgment that's becoming that court's judgment. The court's putting imprimatur on it, and that's a very heavy burden, whether it's stated in a treaty or in case law, whatever, to get past. So you have all those conceivable problems as you're making these kinds of arguments. You've got issues over how is choice of law worked out? Why is French law applying in that kind of a setting? Why would Nicaragua law apply if that was the law? All those things are possible arguments that you can play out. So I would suggest that the first thing you need to think about, whether you're coming in to enforce a judgment or you're trying to contest it, is put yourself in the judge's spot. What sort of cultural feelings is that judge having? And then design your arguments, whether you're on one side or the other, to accommodate those concerns.
Okay. Caroline, now we've talked about judgments in other countries being brought to the United States. What about getting a judgment in the United States? Let's say the contract provides for a consent to jurisdiction, even if it didn't, there's sufficient activity within the United States to justify jurisdiction. Service is effectuated either through some form of domestication of a foreign entity or whatever, and they get the judgment in the United States. What happens if they wanted to take it to China to attempt to enforce the judgment?
Well, I'll have a very discouraging answer for you, unfortunately. There's only a few foreign judgments that has been enforced over the last 10 years in China. China has signed a few bilateral treaties with many countries, such as Cuba, France, Australia, Laos, Turkey, and a few others, but they haven't signed any bilateral treaties to recognize judgment with the U.S., with Canada, the U.K.,
so no bilateral treaties, meaning no reciprocity.
Well, and in the case, even with the countries with which they have signed bilateral treaties, it's nearly impossible to enforce them. And of course, it's not like if there's many cases between Laos and China anyway, right? I would say most of the foreign direct investment to China is coming from the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and countries like this. And there's no treaties between China and these countries.
But you represent a lot of companies from U.S. and places like that that are doing business in China. And so what are you recommending to them as far as what they would do if they ended up in a contract dispute?
Well, most of the time I would recommend two options. First, either to choose Hong Kong as an arbitration center, because there's a treaty between Hong Kong and China. And again, you know, like I've been trying to find some cases where enforcement has been done with Hong Kong cases, and there's like, you know, like just a few. The act, the treaty was signed in 2008, so again, it's only like 5 years, but it's probably one of a good option. The other option is to sign, to have an arbitration clause in your contract, and having an arbitration clause assigning CTAC. Anyone has heard about CTAC? It's a Chinese arbitration center which is really well recognized. And why it's so why I'm such a big fan of it, it's because first, to enforce a judgment in China, a court judgment or an arbitration award, it's easier if it's with Chinese court or arbitration center. But CTAC, the good thing about it is, like, you know, you have to appoint your arbitrators from a list of about 800 arbitrators. About half of it are foreign arbitrators. So you can appoint three arbitrators, and you can have a choice of arbitrators which are from your own country or jurisdiction. So you know that, you know, like, it will bring like more neutrality in the decision, but I believe it's going to help you. And CTAC has been around since 1956. The other good option, and I see Eckert, who is like waving his hand, it's about CELA, which CIAC, which is a arbitration center between Europe and China. It's something that has been signed in 2008, and you can choose this arbitration commission as well. It's a newer one, but it has great potential, definitely. But because, like, you know, like, the arbitration award would be rendered in China, it's definitely easier to enforce it, more than if you have like a Shanghai Arbitration Commission hearing your case.
I'm going to ask you kind of a hard question, but it seems to me, use it as food for thought. If a Chinese company had assets in the United States, mm-hmm. including perhaps an account, a bank account, yep. in the United States, and then the litigation were begun in the United States, and certain prejudgment remedies were sought, such as attachment, or if there is a sort of a security interest in it, a claim and delivery or replevin or whatever, what effect would that have from the China end? Is there something that the Chinese law would do that could attempt to reach into the U.S. and undo that?
You know, frankly, if the assets of the defendant are in the U.S. or in Canada or in the country, I would strongly suggest to start legal proceeding in that country. Right. For me, like, the real rule is about where are the assets of the defendant. Right. We represent mostly mid-sized companies, and most of the mid-sized companies, they deal with mid-sized Chinese companies, and their assets are in China. Of course, if you deal with Huawei, ZTE, which are huge Chinese companies, their assets are all over the world. So it does give you a big help if you start legal proceeding. And I think it would be easy to enforce, even with the Chinese court or a foreign court.
So there's no way to sort of magically undo that.
No.
That's good.
I had a question, Caroline. In the United States, I think we're all familiar with the procedure whereby an arbitration award is confirmed as a judgment of the court. Is there a analogous procedure in China if you obtain an arbitral award, or is there a way to convert that into a judgment, or is that just destined to be an arbitral award?
It's going to be an arbitral award.
Okay,
it's going to be final, confidential, and it's going to be, cannot convert it.
Okay.
And let's see, I think it was Eckert that had mentioned earlier the idea that companies will just change names, put assets in another entity, keep going. A lot of that going on in China?
Well, it does, unfortunately. You know, like, China is not a perfect legal system. As most of you know, it's a civil law jurisdiction. Since China signed the WTO, like, they have amended about 3,000 law. So they're really trying to be up to speed and to make sure their law are similar to what we have in the Western world. But educating about 1.3 billion people takes time. And I know, like, there's a few IP lawyers in the room, and a lot of people are always afraid about IP in China. What should they do? Should they register? If there's an IP infringement, should we sue in China? You know, like, all these questions, like, there's a lot of IP, there's a lot of IP enforcement, but again, it's far from being perfect. But China itself is a country with a lot of litigation. You know, like, I was checking numbers this morning, and last year there was 12 million cases, litigation cases. I'm not talking about arbitration, but it's a lot of cases. In terms of IP cases, about, like, you know, like, people suing each other in China, there's about 34,000 IP cases. And out of these 34,000 IP cases, Guess how many involve a foreign company? Everybody would say half, right? At least?
Say more.
Only 4,000 out of the 34,000 involve a foreign company, which means that Chinese companies start to see value in IP, and they're trying to enforce their right and go to court. So again, these are all numbers for me that are really positive because people in China are become more aware of the law about how to sue, what they should do, how they should respect other people's right. So I think it's getting there, but it's the same, you know, in terms of enforcement of foreign judgment. The civil law procedure, there's a few articles that do mention that Chinese courts should recognize them, but they don't yet. Because, you know, like, frankly, and, you know, like, when Chad said, like, a judgment of 50 pages, a judgment in China, even if it involves, like, you know, 5, 10, 20 million, will be half a page. So if you ask a judge in China to review a case law from the U.S. or from Canada, which is, like, you know, many, many pages, it's going to turn them off, you know. So they'll try to do a shortcut, and they'll say, oh, we don't enforce it cases.
I think you told me that the end-all, be-all, at least in enforcement of a foreign judgment in China, reciprocity is going to be a real primary consideration, right?
It will. And, you know, like, there's a few
If you want a chance of enforcing it, there better be reciprocity.
Yeah, definitely. But there's a few good news for, like, U.S. company, because I was reading that there's a judgment that was there's a Chinese judgment that was recognized in the U.S. at the end of April 2013. This was from the Hubei province, which is north of China. There's another judgment from Jiangsu court, which has been enforced in Germany. So I think, like, you know, as time goes by, like, because other countries will recognize Chinese judgment, it's going to definitely, like, you know, encourage a Chinese court to reciprocate foreign judgment enforced in China.
Okay, now Lipu to the rescue. Lipu, tell us what you've actually done, not just theoretical stuff, but what really happens. When have you gotten contacted by U.S. attorneys?
Okay. First of all, that we need to bear in mind that Taiwan, due to the practical situations, is not a contracting country to New York Convention or the Hague Convention. However, in terms of the enforcement of the foreign judgment or the foreign arbitration award, Taiwan is very open-minded. Our Supreme Court already said that as long as that the foreign countries, under the foreign countries' law, a Taiwanese judgment can be recognized and enforced, then the Taiwanese court will enforce the foreign judgment. There is no legal requirement to prove that a Taiwanese judgment is actually enforced in the foreign country as the prerequisite to enforce a foreign judgment in Taiwan. So therefore, it's very easy. I would not say easy, but it's very. There is a very high possibility to enforce a foreign judgment in Taiwan. And from my experience, we do a lot of enforcement of the foreign judgment work. I receive inquiries from U.S. attorneys or the attorney from the common law countries. They ask me, the first one, I'm going to sue the defendant in Taiwan. Can you help me to serve? You know, as a lawyer, I never reject any opportunity to make money from the foreign colleagues. So, of course, they say, yes, I can help you to serve. But, you know, although I'm a lawyer, but I have a very bad quality for the lawyer. That is, I'm very honest, so I always remind him that. Are you going to enforce this, the foreign American judgment in Taiwan? Yes, they say, yes, otherwise why I want to sue? Then and I will respond to him now, okay, if you want to enforce American judgment in Taiwan, then I cannot help you to serve because it's illegal. What do you mean by that? Under the law of Taiwan, or you can say that is the common future of the civil country, which means that Taiwan, Japan, Korea, almost the same. If you want to enforce a foreign judgment in these countries, you need to duly serve to the defendant. What do you mean by the duly serve or legally serve? It means that the summons, the civil complaint or the notice of the first hearing have to be done, comply in consistence with the local law, which means your service must be complied with Taiwanese law, Korea law, or Japanese law. And what is the difference between the seafloor countries, and what is the difference in terms of the service between the seafloor countries and the common law countries, or like the United States? The big difference is that in the seafloor countries such as Taiwan, Japan, Korea, the service is done by the court, not by the private party or the lawyers. So I cannot serve. I cannot serve if I want to comply with Taiwanese law. So therefore, if you want to serve the party defender in Taiwan, Japan, Korea, you need to ask the Taiwanese court, Korea court, Japanese court to do the service. Okay, generally by the means of the letter of interrogatory under the Hague Convention. So if you This is the. I think this is the most important rule is that in order to enforce American judgment in the civil countries, you really need to pay attention in the service, the rule, the law of the service, and it creates a very difficulty. That is that generally, if you want to serve to the civil countries, American judge doesn't know how to do and what to do, except for, I mean, like New York City or the. In some court in California, they have plenty of experience. My experience is that in some Midwest or southern part of the United States, their judge doesn't know how to serve, and therefore the procedure can take a very, very long time. So I think that is the big problem in the United States in terms of the foreign enforcement of the foreign judgment.
How about arbitration in Taiwan?
Arbitration in Taiwan is even to enforce the foreign arbitration in Taiwan is easier than the judgment, because we don't because under our arbitration laws, you just basically as long as this judgment is conduct is the service is inconsistent with the Taiwanese law, and is properly translate into the Chinese, and you can go to a very fast track proceeding. You don't need to have a hearing, then you can get enforcement.
I think a question on a lot of folks' minds is probably how much does it cost to properly serve someone in Taiwan?
Oh, okay. The good news is that the Taiwanese lawyers maybe is the cheapest lawyer in the world. But we should know that for the arbitration is very cheap, because it's not go subject to the trial proceeding. But to enforce in terms of enforcement of foreign judgment, the cost is about 1% of the amount you will try to enforce, if that is the monetary judgment.
So you do it on a percentage basis, or that
yes,
just is?
Yes, we use a percentage basis.
Wow. Okay. Anybody else with questions amongst the panelists?
Well, I've got a comment. What you can run into, there are rules that are abided by, and there are rules that aren't abided by. So just had a colleague write to me about a story in getting a judgment in South America, taking a judgment from the U.S. down there. It was actually a law firm judgment for fees that weren't paid. And it took a period of, I think, a year to get a proper authentication. Now, there is the Hague Convention to be able to take something down there. There's an apostille authentication in fairly simple form. The courts wouldn't accept it. So what are you to do in that kind of a setting? The court says no. You say yes. Who's going to win that fight? And so the delays can be austere. The surprises can be beyond any reasonable sense in advance. Just have to assume something bad is going to happen in the process of trying to take down what you think are streamlined practices and getting courts to agree with you in other jurisdictions as to what should happen. Now, I do want to make a little comment about arbitrations, too. There is a drafting issue here that is very important. We've all had clients who have done a lot of commerce without any agreements at all, other than the purchase order, the invoice, that type of thing, and woe be the case where you've got a client that somehow got to enforce this or someone enforces it against them, they're in a world of hurt. But just because you've drafted an arbitration clause doesn't mean that it's going to inure to your benefit if you picked not enough language in terms of how the procedure is going to be handled. If you're not in the ICC or AAA or CTAC, those kinds of things, you just pick an arbitrator. We're going to settle it in that fashion. Well, there are no rules, really, a procedure at that point. The arbitrator decides those, and that is fodder for challenge later on. So it's very important that drafting of arbitration provisions, if you're going to put an agreement together, you actually think about what if we have to enforce this? Not just winning a case. It's wonderful to win a case. The problem is, what do you do with it? And I would suggest, too, with regard to this whole process, that before you begin the trek to a different country to enforce something, you ask yourself some questions for your client. And you know you're going to have time and expense. You know it's going to be a surprise to some degree. It may be an impediment you can't get past, but just ask yourself, why will this effort help? What's going to happen here? Where are the assets? That's the question we've been talking about. That's the first thing you want some intelligence on. Where are the assets? Are they going to be reachable under wherever you're chasing them, under the law, just in general? If you get a judgment, what can you do in terms of enforcing against assets? And how will a court in a foreign country help you? What are you expecting to happen? What's going to that court going to give you? And those are tough questions. It's usually in the negative. You're going to hear a lot of uncertainties and about problems, but you want to think about that first, ask before you get started, because otherwise you're going to run a real risk of doing something that down the line is going to cause a client to be very unhappy with you. And it happens in any context, whether it's the court or the arbitration setting, that these are difficult questions. They're intractable in many instances, and that's why enforcements aren't occurring. So when you're drafting the contracts, think about what's going to happen if there's a dispute and you can't enforce it, even if you've gotten an arbitration award and the like. Is there some recourse? You're not going to get in a setting if you have an injunction. You're not going to get a court in a foreign country to adopt your injunction. You might get a money judgment at best. So these are all questions for a lot of advanced discussion.
Speaking of unhappy clients, what about when somebody files bankruptcy, when the defendant files bankruptcy?
Well, in that setting, and I'll just talk about it from the direction of coming into the U.S. bankruptcy courts, bottom line is you're going to have the protections that any other individual would have, a domestic individual. You're going to have the same claim filing deadline, basically. You may get some more time with regard to notice and ask for some more time because you're going to have to serve somebody in a foreign country if something's going on like that. As the materials point out, you're also going to have different approaches to different claims, and there are a number of claims, and I'll just speak to a few of them. Tax claims, rent claims, employee claims, claims for unmatured interest, those types of things are not going to be recognized in the U.S. They won't be recognized coming from a different country either. So the character of the claim is going to be important. Otherwise, if you're falling within the strictures of claims, you're going to be able to proceed. Now, going the other direction, we have something that's also in the materials, Chapter 15 of the Bankruptcy Code, which has adopted to a great degree the model law on cross-border insolvency, which allows somebody who's got a bankruptcy proceeding in a different country to avail itself through a representative of our courts in the process of unwinding a company. So okay. Those are all mechanisms that have been working in the U.S. bankruptcy court setting.
Okay. Well, let's draw some conclusions. We really sound like Debbie and Donnie Downer in this. Nobody seems to have any great optimism that enforcing judgments here that are rendered elsewhere or enforcing judgments that are rendered here somewhere else is going to be easy to do. And so what conclusions we can draw are that your documents are going to be important. And knowing that some of you folks are in the general counsel offices, I'm just certain that all those decisions to do business with a business in a foreign country are run by you before they're even done. As you know, there's no way that happens. If you're lucky, you got to see the contract before the goods shipped or were shipped. And but if you can, your documents can help a lot to narrow the jurisdiction, the choice of the law, the choice of the forum. That is something that you can prepare for that can help you. And then also keep in mind, at my table at lunch, I was saying that I do business litigation, and the last case that I had that went to a jury trial was going on when Obama was inaugurated the first time. And somebody at the table said, well, that's sooner than I've had one. So cases, the idea that business litigation cases are actually going to trial, it's just a smidgen of them that will. And so in a lot of ways, what you're doing is you're putting pressure on the other side and you're seeking to get it resolved voluntarily in some way. So you're preparing for the worst, getting your documents ready, and then once it hits the fan, you're deciding where to sue, and you're certainly deciding where the assets are now. And I offer up to you that if you look to Primaris lawyers, you can find a number of lawyers who are from other countries. And so it's worthwhile to propose what would happen if I sued there, or there are certain assets that are there now, or there are certain assets that I think are here. And if you give forethought before you haul off and file something somewhere, then maybe you can improve your odds of doing well in your litigation. Any questions from the group? Comments? Yes, ma'am.
We cannot agree on whose law will apply to the contract. So I'm at the dilemma of, do we remain silent? Do we choose some third party place that might be nice, like Napa, California? Or do I have to concede to their side? If you had your choice and you the law in, let's say it's the state of wherever it is, the other place, is not good for you, what would you do? Be silent, choose some other party's other state, or go with the one that you didn't like?
I would never be silent if I could get an agreement, because that's just an unbelievable morass of uncertainty going forward. And sometimes you can't get an agreement. Sometimes you can't and shouldn't get a deal done if you think there's going to be some controversy. Now, business people have to make business risk analysis here. And sometimes they'll decide just to go forward with a contract, knowing that there's a whole lot of litigation risk because they want the contract. And oftentimes we see it. It's easy for me to say, draft it this way, draft it that way, but the business people have to make the decisions as to what's the acceptable level of risk. And they may never have a problem with certain parties. You do business all the time with Asia, and everyone will tell you from a standpoint of cultural issues that they're looking for friendships and relationships, not contracts, and that may work very well with some people, but if there's a serious problem, you're not protected.
We sometimes will advise our client that if you cannot reach agreement in the jurisdiction, and we will advise that if party A want to sue party B, and then the jurisdiction court is the court of the party B, vice versa. The advantage of this kind of clause is that actually it increases the difficulty of any potential lawsuit, and which will actually encourage the party to settle the dispute outside of the court.
And I've had that with one recently in Japan. That works to keep you out of a dispute until you're in a dispute. And once you're in a dispute, then it's not a good situation if your client actually then has to go to court or arbitration somewhere. It puts some rigor behind the notion of mediating first and the like. But I will make one comment. I know this is sounding kind of negative to you. There's inspiration for some of you coming from Winston Churchill, who said during some dark day in England, success is stumbling from failure to failure with no loss of enthusiasm. So if you can adopt something like that, that's fine. The problem is his measure of and definition of success isn't often what I find with the companies and their general counsel evaluating success when I present them with a bill trying to enforce a judgment somewhere else. But there's at least that much.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, a very quick one. A lot of our clients, you know, when they first go to China, they think like the Chinese companies are really keen on them. And over the last 15 years, I've seen a big change. Chinese companies are not so dying to do business with us anymore. They're very independent. They're really keen on the local market. And they think it's so much easier to do business when their counterpart than with us. We're like, you know, very demanding in terms of quality control, delivery, and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of our clients, especially when they do a technology transfer agreement, for example, they'll want to have U.S. law, Canadian law to apply because they feel more comfortable. But depending on the contract, you know, like Chinese law would have to apply first. So we have to make sure to know what is the situation in the jurisdiction. And second, I always think it's an easy battle and we should let them win. You know, like if we're going to argue about things with a Chinese counterpart, one thing that we should let them win after, of course, telling them that we would much prefer to have U.S. or Canadian law to apply, to say, listen, if it really makes you happy, we're going to put Chinese law and a CTAC clause, but I want ABC. So for me, like, you know, it would be a very safe bet to do it and to choose as a Chinese law as an applicable law.
I would say also with that, if you're talking about two different states in the U.S. as opposed to different countries' laws, then your choice of law could be one way with one particular state, and then your choice of forum and personal jurisdiction, acknowledgement of personal jurisdiction over the parties, could be a different state. So there's sort of a little bit of room for compromise there if you might want to let loose on one of those but agree to the other or something like that. You might be able to work out something along those lines. Okay, getting you. Let him get you the microphone.
I want to share with you one story which gets it all. I'm presently serving as the chairman of an arbitration tribunal at CTAC in Shanghai. And so I really get some insights of how it functions. And I must honestly say I've never been vested with so much power like in that case as the chairman of that tribunal. I can do really everything. For example, Article 41 of the CTAC rules gives me the choice of either going the contradictory adversarial approach or to go the investigatory approach. So on the one hand, I have American-driven Chinese trying to get electronic discovery of all kind of emails over many years. On the other side, I have like of European-driven parties. And all of that is happening because the parties didn't think about it and made this compromise of a CTAC clause. So it's, of course, Chinese procedural law which I have to apply together with my colleagues. And on the other hand, we have German substantive law. So whenever you have this conflict of different law and different site, there is a risk. And there is a new arbitration, there is a new civil procedure law since 1 January this year in China. There's an Article 274 in there. If I make one formal error, only one, whatever it is, and one party will not be happy and will look for this formal error, they can go to the People's Court and can annul the judgment. And if they do so, then, you know, look one article later, you have an option to restart an arbitration or to go directly to the People's Court. So signing on to a CTAC arbitration, depending on the situation, may also be some risky. But do not discriminate anybody. If you go to my country, which is Germany, it may be tougher or just as tough. I'm just having a Turkish client realizing a check of 185,000 euros in court fees just to file a claim for recognition and enforcement.
Wow. So. Okay. Well, there you have it. Thank you. And if anybody has further questions, I'm sure our panelists will be available.
Betty, every big room of lawyers deserves a war story, so I'll give you one.
All right.
Mike, we sued a Canadian company in Florida for events arising out of some employment practices in the Bahamas. The defendants moved to transfer the case to the Bahamas on the grounds that it was a more appropriate forum, and the district court in Florida said no, that these plaintiffs are entitled to have their suit heard here under American law. Not to be deterred, the defendants then went to the Bahamian courts and got an order from a Bahamian judge that said, you're enjoined from prosecuting this case in the United States, and we're entering sanctions against you for prosecuting the case in the state. So that was the Bahamian order, and frankly, it was broad enough that neither I nor my partner wanted to go to the Bahamas for depositions for fear of ending up in a Bahamian prison for contempt. But at the end of the day, the defendants, after the case in the states was over, brought that judgment over to Florida and sought enforcement. And the state court judge said that a federal court deemed these plaintiffs entitled to bring the suit here, and I'm not going to enforce a judgment that would penalize them for having done so. So the moral of the story is that if you win the forum fight, you just might win the judgment fight, too.
Okay. Thank you.
I haven't been back to the Bahamas since.
Thank you.
Our next panel